This is Classic Rain number 7 for October 25th, 2019. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Here's a trivia question for you. Who is the only ham to be awarded Lifetime President Emeritus for his presidency of the American Radio Relay League, ARRL, from 1972 to 1982, and QCWA, the Quarter Century Wireless Association, from 1989 to 1994? Here's a clue. QCWA recognized this ham for 70 years of service to amateur radio in 2016. He's Harry Danels, W2HD, a longtime resident of Charlottesville, Virginia, now in his 73rd year as a ham. Incidentally, Harry was a driving force behind the no-code tech license. Rain's founder, Hap Holly, KC9RP, had a lengthy conversation with Harry in March 1993, shortly before Harry was awarded the prestigious Ham of the Year by the Dayton Amateur Radio Association at their Dayton Hamvention banquet that spring. Here's part one of Hap's conversation with Harry.
Well, actually, Hap, I started when I was 10 years old. My dad, W2GG, and also K4GG, at the time of his death, was a pioneer in radio, and I just sort of naturally took to it when I was 10. I learned the code when I was 10. Had there been a novice license at that time, I probably would have been licensed very shortly thereafter. However, we made a number of moves, and each time we moved, I had to catch up with my schoolwork. And then along came World War II, and I was down in the Panama Canal Zone where my dad was stationed in the Navy. And I didn't get out of the Navy myself. I joined down there, and I didn't get out until I was 19. So I was actually licensed as a teenager, but about 9 years after I would have been licensed otherwise. Had there been a novice license then, I probably would have been licensed at 10, because I was doing all 13 to 15 words a minute before I was 11.
I suspect a lot of new hams don't realize that a novice license and or tech license have only been here the last 40 years or so.
It's been 40 years, a little bit more than 40, when the FCC initiated the novice, the tech, and the extra, and of course only recently since they issued the no-code tech. Back when a lot of us were young, they had a Class B, which was the entry level, or a C if it was a conditional class, and then the only other class was Class A, and you had to wait a year before you could even take that exam.
What was the first rig you had as a ham?
My first rig was, believe it or not, it was a converted command set from World War II surplus. I had bought an 80-meter command set, one that covered 3 to 4 megacycles, and I converted that and put it on the air on 80 CW. Then I took another one of them and put it on 40 CW. And those were my first radios. I used my dad's receiver, but I used my own transmitter.
If it covered 3 to 4, why did you have to modify it?
I just had to modify it to work on regular power supplies, because they were meant to work, of course, in aircraft. And most of the radio gear at that time was 6-volt, but the military stuff was 12, and they operated on 28 volts. So you had to modify the filaments slightly, so you put them on either 12 volts or put in 6-volt tubes.
Did you engage in daily schedules with anyone early on, or did you just talk to whoever you ran into?
No, my first interest was traffic handling, because as a Navy radio operator during the latter part of World War II, I had been in traffic handling at the station in the Canal Zone. And it was just a natural. I listened in on the nets, and I heard them. I became interested and immediately went into traffic handling, and that started a career with the ARRL in various capacities. I started out in the traffic handling business and was so active there that I became assistant section communications manager, asked by the local section communications manager to take on that responsibility. Then I ran successfully for the Office of Section Communications Manager, and when an opportunity came a few years later to run for Vice Director, I did, and eventually became a vice director of the league. And that started, I guess, the political ascension, if you will, because from vice director I went to director. And from director, the board elected me as the seventh president of the league in 1972.
What time frame are we talking about that you first became a section manager?
Well, I became section manager in the 1952 era, a little bit before that, because I was married in 1952, and I was already doing some of the work of the section manager, who had a heart attack at that time, and I took over his work and then became full-fledged section manager on my own right. I was in the New York City Long Island section of the Hudson Division.
So you became licensed as a ham after World War II was over with, and then in 1952 you became section manager, and 20 years later you became the seventh president of the ARRL. Did you have aspirations to become president of the league when you became a section manager, or is that just how things worked out?
To be perfectly honest, Hap, I never even thought there was a chance in the world. There were so many wonderfully qualified people. The late Vic Clark, W4KFC, is an example of that. He and I served on the board at the same time as directors, and I thought he should become president. He thought I should become president, and he prevailed and would not even accept the nomination because he thought I should do the job. And I just honestly never expected it. It was a complete surprise.
What was the most difficult part or the most difficult task you had while being president of the ARRL?
I don't believe there was anything that was very difficult. Frankly, I worked with a wonderful bunch of people, very cooperative. The directors were cooperative, and the management of the league accepted me. I was the second youngest president of the league ever. The first president was Hiram Percy Maxim, and I think he was just a little bit younger than I when he became the first president. And I think I was very fortunate in having just a wonderful bunch of people to work with. I think the one of the hardest jobs we had was the preparation for the World Administrative Radio Conference in 1979, commonly called Work 79, because the league had to undertake a lot of special preparations to make sure that amateur radio was properly represented. And as you know, we were highly successful in obtaining some new bands as a result of that, and that was through the effort of a very wonderful group of people who worked in the planning and preparation.
Now, much to your credit, I recall there was publicity in preparation for the conference as early as 1972, long before the conference, whereas in the last World Administrative Radio Conference that was held in... What year was that?
Well, just very recently, only a few years ago.
Okay. I don't recall very much publicity at all for that, even during the last year of that. Was this conference less critical than the WARC of 79?
Yes, it was. Actually, the preparation for Work 79 commenced with a very forward-looking president of the league, Herb Hoover, W6ZH, who foresaw a frequency conference, a general frequency conference, which was very important because it would affect all the radio spectrum. And he predicted that or knew that it was coming. It was postponed and delayed due to administrations and other people around the world not being prepared. It gave us a better opportunity to prepare also. And unfortunately, Herb was never alive at the time when his early efforts to start the whole preparation began. And that's unfortunate because he was a very forward-looking person and did see the eventual conference and the need for us to be more than just adequately prepared.
You're listening to a conversation with ARRL and QCWA President Emeritus Harry Danels, W2HD. We'll continue Hap's 1993 interview with Harry in a moment. This is Classic Rain number 7. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
So you learned the code when you were 10, became a ham at age 19. When the novice license became part of the amateur radio licensing structure in, what was it, 52?
52, yes.
How did that change the hobby?
Well, it was viewed at that time by the older time hams as selling amateur radio, I think, quote, down the river, unquote. But not to me. I saw it as an opportunity to take in new people who would, once again, get their feet wet and interested in amateur radio. And if you take a look at today's radio amateurs, I would dare say that the novices of the past have certainly shown themselves to be shining lights. For example, let me just use a very simple example. I think one of the best ones is W3BE of the Federal Communications Commission, John Johnston. John started as a novice, and Ralph Hauer, his immediate supervisor, also started as a novice. And if you look at the hams who have been part of the ARRL Board of Directors and the present general manager, executive vice president, Dave Sumner, all of these people, or a great number of them, began their amateur careers as novices. I don't think that anyone looking back at their recent contributions would say that they were would have been a loss, or not a loss, but would have been a detriment to amateur radio. They have been just tremendous contributors, all of them, and I think today's results of the novice license have proven it to be the license I had hoped it would be, and it was.
It's interesting, the parallel in thought on behalf of some hams, that the no-code license is being viewed as selling amateur radio down the river, as the novice license was viewed 40 years ago.
Well, I used that example of 1952 when I went around speaking to amateur radio clubs here in Virginia. Shortly after I moved here, people asked me if I would speak at some of the clubs, and I did. And the no-code issue was very prominent. And I used the example of the old-timers in 1951 when the novice was first announced as coming into being, and said there was a great fear about amateur radio going down the drain. And I said it hasn't, and it won't. And it won't with the introduction of this no-code license either. The requirements are still there to learn something, and I think that we have a tremendous number of people who have come into amateur radio via the no-code route and almost immediately have realized that there's still more they could do if they did learn the code. And I believe a great percentage of the no-coders are becoming coded techs and later general and even higher.
It is ironic, Harry, that when you became president of the QCWA's Quarter Century Wireless Association, that organization is actually whose proposal was adopted by the FCC for the no-code licensee. And I think it's interesting to note that an organization whose members have been in amateur radio at least 25 years are those who actually helped to push the no-code license through.
You've hit on a very interesting point, Hap, and I must admit that at the time that the no-code license came into view as something that the FCC definitely was going to propose, and it had been defeated, you know, back in the early 80s, there had been such a strong letter-writing campaign to the commission that the whole thing was dropped. But this time it was rather obvious that they were going to bring forth some form of no-code license. Rather than have it something that we didn't desire that might not work, several of us on the QCWA board, and I have to mention Lou McCoy, W1ICP, and others of the board, and I felt that we should try to craft the new codeless tech to become something that would be a contributing force to amateur radio. I think that what we proposed was largely the best thing that could have been proposed, because it did integrate this new form of license almost immediately into what I term the mainstream of amateur radio, the activity on the VHF bands, especially 2 meters, which is so popular in all communities, and you meet all walks of life via 2 meter repeaters. Had they been denied the access to 2 meter repeaters, I'm afraid the no code text would have grown, almost like weeds in the desert without any direction. And I think it was just fine that the commission adopted our proposal to allow them to work 6 meters and above.
Why did the league want to keep the no codes off 2 meters? Any handle on that, why that would be?
Well, I think the league was in an unfortunate situation at that moment in time. Otherwise, they might have proposed exactly what we did. They were fighting the loss of the lower 2 megahertz of the 220 band. To even indicate remotely that the real activity on ham radio was not, let's say, above 220 and above, would have been a very strong political error. And I think they almost had to take the position they took. And they used the word to integrate this new licensee into what they called the mainstream of amateur radio, which was 220 and above. And that just is not true. But they found themselves in a position where I think it was necessary to do that. There might have been an underlying cause, too, where some of the 2 meter repeater users were afraid that their 2 meter repeaters would be infiltrated by people who were not worthy to become hams. That has not been true in any of the areas where I've noticed the growth of amateur radio. I think the no-code tech has been a contributor. They certainly are here in Charlottesville, Virginia, I can tell you that.
What turned the tide toward favoring no-code?
Well, for many years, Hap, the code as a an interesting mode of operation has dropped off, even in the amateur ranks. The current multi-mode transceivers with everything in there. In the old days, you build an oscillator and an amplifier, and if you had enough money, you build a modulator and you maybe went on phone. But today, with the proliferation of very excellent, I might say, commercial equipment, with multi-mode capabilities on all of the bands, voice operation and other operation, digital operation, has become very prominent. And I think that that's one of the things that prompted people to sort of fade away a little bit from Morse code, not to indicate that the bands aren't still very active with Morse code, and I'm happy to see it. And frankly, I can still scratch two wires together and send SOS with a spark coil and maybe be heard by someone. And I think that's important to be able to do that. But at the same time, from a practical sense, the modern equipment and so forth and the modern techniques and the reliability of the equipment is such that the Morse code is taking a back seat. You have to look at the commercial use of the Morse code. The Navy, a strong user of Morse code for literally decades and decades, hardly has a radio operator on board any of their vessels anymore. They just don't need them because the reliability of satellite communications and other modes offsets the reliability that they once had with Morse code.
And that's part one of a 1993 conversation between ARRL and QCWA President Emeritus Harry Danels, W2HD, and Hap Holly, KC9RP. We'll bring you more excerpts from Hap's interview with Harry in Classic Rain number 8, the weekend of November 8. That does it for Classic Rain number 7, a biweekly production of the Radio Amateur Information Network. Copyright from the Dawn of the Horseless Carriage, or 1989, 2019 Rain. All rights reserved. Very 73 from the Radio Amateur Information Network. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Keep on hamming.